Welcome to this Martin Bailey Photography Podcast, episode number 52. It's first this week as I am going to release two episodes in 1 week. I'm going to continue taking a brief look at each episode to date, giving you a brief mention of what's been discussed and mention one or two of the main points from that podcast. The thing is that I didn't want this to drag out for too many weeks, so I've pushed the boat out a little and gone and done another one. As with the last two summaries, I won't be covering all of the tips and the techniques, of course, as this would take just as long as listening to all of the original episodes. These summaries will give you the gist of what I've covered so far. There are many more pearls of advice hiding in the old episodes, though, so hopefully this will just give you some pointers as to what episodes you want to go back and listen to, either for the first time, if you're a first-time listener, or to recap on what's been discussed in the past for the older listeners. Let's pick up the trail this week with episode number 23. Episode 23, we talked about using telephoto lenses. Using a telephoto lens does not seem that daunting, but when you start getting past a few hundred millimeters, a few things start happening that aren't obvious until you actually try it. Firstly, I explained what constitutes a telephoto lens. I'm sure there are varying opinions on this, but in 35mm terms, generally from 60 to 100mm is short telephoto. A 200mm lens would be considered medium telephoto, and a 300mm lens long telephoto. Anything from 400mm and above is considered super telephoto. The first thing you're going to find is that telephoto lenses are much more susceptible to camera shake. This is because you're magnifying the subject more and more as the focal length increases, and so magnifying any movement in the camera and the lens when shooting. This is compounded by the fact that the bigger the lens gets, the heavier it is, and so the harder it is to keep still if you're hand-holding. The rule of thumb for using the focal length as the minimum shutter speed is worth getting used to. That is, if you're shooting at 100mm, you need a minimum shutter speed of 1/100th of a second, and that needs to be increased to 1/160th of a second if you're working with a camera with a 1.6 times crop factor. Another example would be, say, a 300mm focal length with a 1.6 times crop factor would need a 1/500th of a second shutter speed, which is the next speed up from 480. The image stabilizing or vibration reduction systems will help, of course, by two or three stops, maybe more in the newer models, but you can go back to episode 10 to learn how to calculate your new shutter speeds in stops if you aren't used to doing this. Increasing the ISO to get a faster shutter speed and also using a tripod or monopod for longer telephoto lenses is recommended, but too fast an ISO will introduce grain and you'll still have to deal with subject movement when using a tripod. The other thing to keep in mind with long telephoto lenses is that the longer the lens gets, the shallower the depth of field gets. For small birds, say, the depth of field does not have to be that great to get a fair amount of the bird in focus. But when you consider, for example, that when shooting something 10 meters away for, that would be about 32 feet, with a 400mm lens, the depth of field is only 20 centimeters or about 8 inches. So if your subject is a large bird with a 30 centimeter or 12 inch wingspan, for example, you're going to run out of depth of field. If this is what you're looking for, that's fine, but it should be borne in mind if you would like to get the subject totally in focus. In episode 24, we kind of followed on from the telephoto lens theme by talking about teleconverters and extension tubes. Canon actually calls teleconverters extenders, which have glass elements, and not to be confused with extension tubes, which do not have any glass. They simply put more space between the lens and the camera body to increase magnification. A teleconverter is a relatively cheap way to increase the focal length of your lenses without affecting the minimum and maximum focusing distances. Extension tubes, on the other hand, shorten the minimum focusing distance so that you can focus on subjects much closer to the lens, so they're great for macro work. But be careful with extension tubes, though, as they not only shorten the minimum focusing distance, they greatly minimize the maximum focusing distance to just a few inches in front of the lens in some cases. There are lots of applications for both that I explain in detail in episode 24, and there are certain combinations of extender that aren't supported too, so please check your lens manual for compatibility or check at the camera store before buying anything. Again, as you increase your focal length using a teleconverter, the depth of field gets shallower, as it does when using an extension tube as well, because you're effectively much closer to the subject. From episode 25 to 28, we embarked on a kind of travelogue of my February trip to Hokkaido, looking at images of Japanese red-crowned cranes, stella and white-tailed eagles, deer and seals, among other things. There were a fair number of tips and techniques discussed throughout these four episodes, but I'll just touch on a few of the main ones here. When shooting wildlife, especially birds, that can be far away most of the time, you need a super telephoto lens to fill the frame with them. But then they might just take to the sky and fly right over your heads too, requiring a wider angle to get them in the frame. It's impossible to change lenses, no matter how quickly you can do it, in the few seconds that you have after spotting the approaching birds to actually needing to capture the image. To overcome this, I try to keep an old camera after upgrading to a newer model so that I can take two bodies on trips like this. I've actually just sold my Canon EOS 20D to put the money towards a new lens, so I'll be stuck with my next trip unless I buy a new body by then. But during the February 2006 trip, I used both the 20D and the 5D together to cover all possibilities. In image 863, you can see that I captured a comical scene of a crane kind of shrugging his shoulders in disgust at these damn crows that seem to be everywhere. This was captured with the 5D and a 600mm f4 lens. On the other hand, I used a much shorter focal length of 130mm, that was my 100-400mm lens, on the 20D with a 1.6 times crop factor, which equates to just over 200mm, to capture image number 850, as these five cranes flew in overhead. Both shots would just not have been possible with just the one body. One of the other important tips was getting used to shooting in manual mode for subjects like this that can move between very bright to very dark backgrounds a lot, as aperture or shutter priority modes will be fooled to set the wrong exposure otherwise. I mentioned this in detail in episode 10 and also in episode 50 in the summary of the same, so I won't cover it again today. In the following episode, we looked at some eagle shots, again made with the 600mm f4 lens. My favourite from this episode is probably image number 874 of a white-tailed eagle being regarded by a number of Japanese red-crowned cranes as it passes between them. One of the things I was getting at here is basically the importance of trying to capture something different. It is easy to concentrate on either the eagle or the cranes here, but getting them both in the same shot, kind of with the beautiful cranes taking a side part instead of the center stage, makes for an interesting photograph. I also discussed the Wimberley head, which is a tripod head that I use with the 600mm f4 lens, and it enables me to balance the lens so well that I can swing it around as though I'm hand-holding. It's basically very important for a lens of this size and weight to be able to do that. I also use the AI servo focusing mode at times like this too, as the birds move very fast, and I also have my 5D set up so that the AF stop button on the lens switches between one-shot focusing and AI servo focusing when pressed, which I find invaluable, especially when you can lock the focus on, you know, you can lock the focus with one shot and then just move the main subject off-center to avoid bullseyeing the subject in the center of the frame. There were a few more tips on shooting in cold weather, like taking a small solid fuel burner, hand warmer, to keep not just your hands warm, but your equipment warm. A fleece cover for the camera with a pocket on the inside for the hand warmer will increase your battery life quite a lot and help to prevent camera trouble in extreme cold conditions. In the third episode from the series, one of the main tips was to rest your monopod on your boot when shooting from a boat with the engine running. I was doing this while shooting images like number 907 of a pair of Stellar Eagles quibbling over a scrap of fish, which they ended up dropping, and so eventually they both lost out. If you find a boat tour company that is prepared to stop the engines for you, you don't need to worry about this, but most of the time they are manoeuvring around quite a lot, so keep they generally tend to keep the engine running. This causes a lot of vibration that will ruin your images if you don't dampen it in some way. For this, I came up with the idea of putting the monopod on my boot. I guess you could, with this in mind, use, you know, you could maybe make a sponge or something that will absorb the shock and put that on there as well. And that would help you to keep balance, because you really can't keep that good a balance if you've got one foot in a position that you don't want to move. So the tip is only really half good. The thing that I'll probably do next time is to take a large piece of foam or something and to, you know, I'll rest the monopod on that. If you are actually sailing at the time as well, I really don't recommend standing up at all, let alone trying to shoot with your, you know, the monopod on your boot, because you really do need all the balance you can get while the boat is moving. And, you know, it'd be a great shame if you were to fall into the icy waters yourself. In the very last episode of the series, we looked at some shots from the Hokkaido or Ezo deer, like the one in shot number 927. There were not really any useful tips in this last episode from the series, just more of a closing off. Though I did speak a little about the incredibly harsh conditions in which these deer live, and the problems the growing numbers are causing for the trees, strangely enough, as not having enough food to go around in the winter means the deer turn to eating the bark from the trees, leaving them susceptible to cold and various diseases. In episode 29, we made the jump from the harsh cold of Hokkaido to spring in Tokyo. In image number 942, we can see the blossom of a Japanese apricot tree. I'd actually used my 100mm macro lens with a 25mm extension tube. As I mentioned earlier, an extension tube allows you to get closer to your subject, filling the screen with them. I love this combination and I use it quite a lot. The main tip here was regarding the decision that I made to focus on the rightmost petal on the left-hand side flower, as I wanted the line between the two flowers to be as distinct as possible. The obvious choice might have been to focus on the stamen of either the foreground or the background flower, but this would have meant that the separation between the two flowers was less defined. Episode 30 was pretty much all my impressions from the Photo Imaging Expo 2006, but I did talk about a little about being 100% in agreement with a friend of mine, Yoshiaki Kobayashi, a top nature photographer here in Japan, whose seminar I was lucky to catch. Kobayashi-sensei said that just because digital photography has made it easy to correct exposure in post-processing, there is no excuse for not getting it right when you're shooting the original. Honing your photographic technical skills to the point where you can get your exposure accurate in the field will help you to get the best quality images possible. If you shoot shoddily in the field and then crank up the exposure in post-processing, even if you use RAW, you'll add grain to your images and lower the dynamic range and often the contrast too. If you are going to the trouble to go out and shoot images, make them the best that they can be by learning how to expose them correctly. With the availability of the histogram too now with digital photography, we should be getting better at this. But the fact is that many people are getting sloppier and sloppier because they rely too much on post-processing. Okay, so now we're really getting into the recent memory zone. With episode 31, we kicked off the first photography assignment with the subject of contrasting colours. To illustrate a point, I put a colour wheel on my website. I'll put a link to the colour wheel in today's show notes too, but basically we did an exercise where we opened the colour wheel in one browser window and then opened image number 56 in another window, placing them on your screen so that you can see at least the best part of both of them. You need to be able to see at least the colour of both the orange poppy and the blue Nemophila flowers. Then place your mouse over the colour wheel and move it around until you see an orange similar to that of the orange poppy. It doesn't need to be exactly the same as this, it's just to make a point. If you look at the three vertical rectangles below the colour wheel, you'll see the colours changing and the numbers in the boxes also changing. Once you get something close to the orange of the poppy, click the wheel and the colour that you clicked will be added to the list of colours on the left of the screen. Then move your mouse from that point diagonally straight across the wheel to around the same position on the opposite side and take a look at the colours in the three strips below below the wheel that we looked at earlier. You can click this to add it to the list on the left too, but basically you'll see a light blue, very similar to the colour of the baby blue eyes or the Nemophila flowers. The point here is that colours on opposite sides of the colour wheel that initially appear to be in total contrast actually complement each other from a design perspective. This is why the poppy and the baby blue eyes shot is so eye-catching. In episode 32, I discussed consideration for buying a new tripod. I myself have two tripods, one that is relatively small, but big enough to just about reach my eye level without having to bend over. I actually said in this episode that I did not have to raise the center pole of my Manfrotto 444 Carbon 1 tripod to be able to look through the viewfinder without bending over at all. But this is actually not the case. I actually do need to raise the center pole just a few inches to really get it to eye level when standing up straight. What I find myself doing, though, is rather than raising the center pole, especially if there's a breeze, I open my legs wider apart so that my eye level drops without me having to stoop. Stooping down for any length of time is really not a good thing for your back. And so the advice was to get something that you don't need to stoop to look through the viewfinder. Another piece of advice was if weight or size is not really a consideration, that is if you'll be, say, you're transporting the tripod around mainly by car, a model like my other tripod, which is a Jitso, that is a good meter or so higher than me without the center pole extended, can be very useful. The main benefits I find of having a very high tripod are firstly when shooting in snow, where the feet of the tripod will sink significantly. I do now have some snow feet for the tripod to stop it sinking, but they're not always that practical. They don't always make that much sense. The other time is at shows where there is a crowd and you can, you can't really get in front of the crowd as you don't want to stand there with a big telephoto lens getting in everyone's way. What you can do is stand on steps yourself at the back of the crowd and extend your tripod very high to shoot over the heads of the crowd. There were lots of other considerations, like making sure that you can get the camera to a very low angle for macro work. But if you are considering buying a tripod right now, I advise you take a listen to the episode. One other thing I guess I should mention, especially for new listeners, is that very often a thread is started in the podcast forum at the martinbaileyphotography.com website, and the title of the podcast will be the same as the episode in question. And in that thread, listeners will discuss some of the details and often come up with related ideas and different ways of doing similar things to those that I mention. So if you're catching up with the old episodes, many of these threads will be full of useful information. So check them out as well as you catch up with the archives. Over time, there has been a lot of advice on how to keep camera shake down, but there is often room for even more improvement. And in episode 33, I gave some more advice for reducing camera shake further. I discussed cable and wireless releases and timer controls for tripping the shutter without introducing vibration with your finger. I also mentioned using the mirror lockup feature that most cameras have to lock the mirror up in advance of actually opening the shutter for the exposure, as the movement of the mirror itself can introduce a small amount of vibration. I also discussed the PLAMP from Wimberley, which I believe is short for plant clamp. This is a flexible arm that attaches to your tripod leg or center pole and can be extended to your subject, and then, you know, with a plant or something like that, for example, and then you sort of hold it still while you photograph it. In episode 34, I talked about eyes. I've got a fair few images of close-ups of animals' eyes, and probably my favorite one, probably an alligator's eye that I shot in Florida a few years ago. And then there's the pink flamingo stare that I first showed you way back in episode 1 a year ago. This is image number 595. There are no real tips or techniques introduced in this episode other than those for shooting close-ups with long lenses. When I say this episode, I mean episode 34, that is, not episode 1. But basically, shooting with close-ups with long lenses, and I really just focused on my interest in eyes and the fact that eyes are regarded, and I believe are the windows to the soul. In episode 35, we visited the Chichibu Cement Factory. I'd actually driven over to the Saitama Prefecture a few hours from Tokyo to shoot some colourful fields of creeping phlox, otherwise known as ground pink. However, the best shots from the day came from shooting some frail blue flowers before arriving at the creeping phlox fields. But the most exciting part was going back to an almost derelict factory, a cement factory that we passed on the driving on the shuttle bus from the car park to the fields. I spent just 1 hour and 20 minutes photographing the cement factory and spent a little more time on the way out talking to an ex-employee about the history of the plant. But this was one of the most memorable shoots I believe I'll ever have. The main thing was that I was moved in some way, not just by the visual spectacle of the rusted corrugated steel sidings and the broken windows, but also, for some reason, I seemed to sense the ghosts of the many that had toiled to make a living in these buildings for the 70 years or so that the plant had been in production up until 1993, before leaving the buildings to rot away. The image that will remain in my mind and probably in my portfolio for the longest is number 981 of the inside of a storehouse, of which the corrugated steel walls are now totally rusted through, allowing the light to pour in from outside. The tip here, and yes, there was a tip, was that after I set up the camera on my tripod and decided on the composition, I walked through the scene scuffing my feet on the floor to kick up dust to make the shaft of light coming in from the window above stand out, and made it possible to capture the light itself in the image rather than just relying on the light on the floor to tell the story. Okay, so there are just 14 episodes left to summarize to get to number 49, the episode before we started the summary. So we'll definitely finish it with the next episode. By then, in fact, probably I'd say by the time most of you listen to this podcast, we'll be 1 year old, as I released the first episode on September the 1st, 2005. So thanks very much once again to all of you that keep on listening. Without you guys listening, there'd be no point in any of this. Also, thanks to all of you that responded to my calls to spread the word last month. And thanks to the Photocast Network as well, as we are definitely seeing a lot of new listeners signing up right now, according to the download stats. If you are new to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast, welcome, and I hope that you like what we're doing here, and I hope that it's useful, and that you stay subscribed. Remember that we are still voting for the Depicting Cultures assignment until the end of September 3rd, so if you haven't voted yet, please go to the mbpgalleries.com website and make your selection. Each member only gets one vote, remember, so you can change your selection if you change your mind. You will be asked, though, if this is really what you want to do, and then the system will remove your vote from your old choice and apply it to the new one if you say okay. So that's it for this second episode this week. Enjoy the remainder of the week, whatever you do. And once again, thanks very much to all of you for listening. Bye-bye. The Martin Bailey Photography Podcast is a member of the Photocast Network. Find other great photography-related podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.